welcome everyone here this afternoon to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases that will be argued today. As I understand it, the attorneys have all checked in and are ready. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel. To my left is Justice Wade Birdwell. And I'm Chief Justice Bonnie Sutterth. Would the clerk please call the first case?
The court will now call in the interest of J.C. A. Child. Mr. Thomas and Michelle will argue for the appellant, P.A. Mr. Paul Leopold will argue for the appellees, I.C.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I think we have a fascinating case here this afternoon. I have for some time been trying to advance this case for a father who wants to be a father. He spent his whole life trying to be a father. Granted, he is the biological father, and that's why we're here today. We're here attacking the Texas Family Code provision that unilaterally applies a four-year limitation based on his status as a biological father when the same four-year limitation does not apply to the presumed father. We believe that is an arbitrary deadline. It does not meet the strict scrutinies as set forth by the United States Supreme Court and by other courts of this country. As we know, and we've cited to the court, the constitutional muster that we look at this current family code section under must be defined by the current times. Recently, only last year, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed the federal statute that was gender-based, that had a limitations period for U.S. citizenship different from a mother of 5 years versus, for a father of 5 years versus 1 year for a mother. The Supreme Court of the United States said that many laws and codes, both federal and state, are from an error when the nation's law books were rife with overbroad generalizations about the way men and women are. The U.S. Supreme Court also went on to say that these foundations came from somewhat of an older view of what marriage is, where, number one, the husband is dominant and the wife is subordinate, something we no longer hold true today. Number two, an unwed mother is the sole guardian of a non-marital child, also no longer held true. And as the court is well familiar with, Obergefell decision by Justice Kennedy stated, when new insights reveal discord between the Constitution's central protections and a received legal stricture, a claim of liberty must be addressed. And this claim of liberty must be reviewed in context of today's reality. Today's reality is that 40% of all children are born out of wedlock. 50% of marriages fail. The old rule that came, that this rule stems from trying to keep marital stability and having a presumed father, goes back to Lord Mansfield and trying not to have illegitimate children.
But isn't this statute also for the best interest of the child, so that someone doesn't come into the child's life when they're 5, 6, 7 years old and disrupt the family unit when they have a stable environment?
I think that is to me clearly what they're trying to articulate, but there's not a correlation between that articulation. I think the real answer is not an arbitrary bar of 4 years. However, to leave it back to the discretion of the trial court to decide what is in fact the best interest of the child. In this case, we had over 4 years of interaction between my client thinking he was the father, and when he got the DNA test, not knowing the mother was married, gets the DNA test, and I think for most people, most lay people think, oh, you know, in today's technology, I've got the DNA. I am the father. I've been acting as the father. I think I'm the father. I do not know that the mother is married. And yet there's arbitrary 4 year untied to the stability of the child. The old presumptions that just because you're married and you have what is now the law deems a presumed father means stability is a fiction. In this case,
how is it untied to the stability of the child if the child has been raised by his mother and the presumed father as a family unit. How is it untied to that?
It can be and it can't be, I would say. It's not necessarily. It certainly, well, there was no evidence on any type of empirical data. Not, I'm going to answer your part, Justice Gabriel, in two parts. Empirically, statistics show that, and there is no showing in the trial court below, that this is any way tied to the stability of the child. Number two, if under the facts of this particular case, my client thought he was acting as the father. And I think that's a reflection of modern society as well. I'm not saying it's good, I'm not saying it's right, but it is a reflection of the reality of where we had three people who were raising this child. And we have orders all the time in family courts that come out where we have multiple conservators. I just recently won a case out of the Texas Supreme Court where my clients will be the happen to be grandparents, but they're non-parents. They will now have standing and will have three people involved under the court order. The mother, the father, and the grandparents will all have standing. So it's not an exclusionary thing. I know we tend to think of it as just mom and dad. But in this situation, don't forget this, to show you how unstable it was, the child is a product of an adulterous relationship. So the marital vows were broken. Unbeknownst to my client, who thinks he's the father, goes out and gets a DNA test confirming he's the biological father. Now, one thing we can't
Didn't he do that because he suspected that mom was married? Or she was with someone else all the time?
Possibly. Once again, Justice Gabriel, that is a reality that some people have more than one partner in today's society. It doesn't correlate. It does not correlate, and there is no evidence that it correlates to the stability of the child. I know that is a concept that we've held from the 1700s about having illegitimate children, but we've abolished that concept. And so,
isn't the stability of the child really related to the fact that the child has never known anyone else to be his father other than the presumed father?
That absolutely can be a factor, but it doesn't correlate to this arbitrary 4-year limitation period. What it does correlate to, Justice Gabriel, is a remand to the trial court to determine what is the best interest of the child. The trial court may very well hear the facts of this case, which he was unable to do in this case, and determine, I think this should be the following possession schedule. But what has happened as a result of this arbitrary deadline is this little boy's life is ripped apart from his biological father, who's done nothing more than want to be this child's father, wanted to be in his life, would pay child support, but because of a 4-year limitation period, he's out. So this.
But he hasn't been paying child support.
He would have wanted. He filed this lawsuit to do it.
More than 4 years after the child was born.
Right, he did, but he didn't know. He didn't know she was married. And I will say this. Granted, I'm saying a layperson who goes out and confirms, different than the stability of the child, whether he suspects the mother may be having relationships with another individual as to whether or not he is the father or not the father, but when he did have and get the confirmation that he was the father, he's always wanted to be the child's father. We don't want to punish this man for wanting to stand up for his responsibilities and not run away from them.
But it was still years after he got the DNA results before he filed his action.
Because they were together. It wasn't until the mother withheld the child from him and said, you can no longer see the child. That's when he was forced to file the lawsuit.
Are you really arguing that there is a distinction between how the biological father is treated as opposed to the presumed father? Because the same 4-year statute applies to the presumed father, the only difference being that there's a discovery rule that applies to the presumed father with regard to the mother withholding information concerning the presumed father's non-biological
Correct.
Involvement.
Correct. And interestingly enough, Justice Birdwell, you're raising a very good point. Although the two statutes read somewhat like as a proceeding under Section 160.606, which has no time limitation if there's no presumed father, which is another arbitrary treatment, versus a time limitation if there is a presumed father, But however, Justice Birdwell, remember, if the law designates the father as the presumed father, he's defined as a parent.
Well, I understand
so
that.
It extends the limitation for the presumed father to say that he's not the father. It's a reverse.
It seems a little backward.
It is. I was going to use that exact word. Exactly. It's backwards.
This is kind of what in reviewing the statute was confusing to me, and that is this case has been dismissed because of the statute of limitations.
Correct.
So there's actually been no adjudication of fatherhood, and all it does is leave intact the statutory presumption.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Which there is now a 4-year limitation on the presumed father making that argument, which is probably already passed because he found out about it in 2012.
Right.
But arguably, there's not this is an adjudication by default. In other words, no court has actually made a determination, an adjudication of who the father is, even though it's been brought before that court. And so the presumed father, you know, at this point in time, we don't know whether mom may actually have been sleeping around with someone else. And the presumed father would be barred by the 4-year statute with regard to your client's claims. But if, in fact, she was having an adulterous affair with somebody else, that could be raised later on. And the presumed father has a new 4-year ticking point in time that he could assert. How is that? And the other thing is the statute doesn't apply to the child in any way, and in fact the child has standing upon reaching majority to file a suit for adjudication of fatherhood at that point in time.
That may very well not happen. One of the tragic things of this situation, Justice Birdwell and Justice Gabriel, is this boy will have a hole in his heart. We have a father, a biological father, who wanted to be a father. But to answer your question, Justice Birdwell, it's a little bit different from the presumed father and his ability to deny paternity. That is not a constitutionally protected right. That's, I don't want to say exactly what it is. It's a denial of perhaps of liability. But what it is from my client's standpoint is a constitutionally protected right of the highest order.
Well, the United States Supreme Court hasn't said that.
The United States Supreme Court has absolutely said that this is a more vested property, I mean, not property, constitutional right than any other property right out there. And we've quoted that. Your right to your, obviously, is one of the most fundamental, your own children is one of the most fundamental rights this Constitution can hopefully
guarantee. Well, but in what she's saying, though, correct me if I'm wrong, the Supreme Court specifically said there's no constitutional right to the issue of an adulterous affair, if I remember correctly.
And there's no a biological father's right to establish parentage is not constitutionally protected. They also said that.
Oh, well, remember, in Sessions and Oberfeld, and also the case of the Stately case, that they have held that it is a constitutionally protected right. Now, whether you can get there or not is a different order. Now, remember, we're also many of the cases they've cited in their appellee's brief, starting with the gun case, is a 65 case. In Re K is a 76 case. In Re GM is a 1980 case. Oberfeld came out in 15. Sessions came out in 17. And it's the duty of this court, as we all do, is to analyze the constitutional applications with current situations of what is happening with the reality of life. Oberfeld would not have happened 20 years ago. Oberfeld has happened today. Likewise, today, the statistics on the ground are the reality. We are talking about 40% out of wedlock. We're talking about 50% marriage failures. That does not correlate to the stability of the children.
Well, Obergefell was on a full record That was done on a full record. Where are the statistics that you're citing as part of this record?
I will say they're devoid. The Attorney General was given notice to defend this statute and failed to come forward or present any evidence to defend this statute. That was their opportunity. We even postponed the trial to allow the Attorney General. I personally spoke with them, giving them notice about this. That was their opportunity to come in and try to defend this case on a full record. And the case was continued to give them that opportunity. They declined to do so because I don't think they can support that. We can look at the governmental records, the CDC, we cited it. The problem is, from just an arbitrary four-year deadline, there is no defense in this court that an arbitrary four-year deadline is somehow tied to the stability of the children.
But you keep saying it's an arbitrary deadline. Yes. All numbers are arbitrary.
Correct.
And all statute of limitations deadlines are arbitrary.
Correct.
Because you have to draw the line in the sand somewhere.
Correct.
So the fact that it's arbitrary is not dispositive.
Well, I think it is in this case because in order to meet the strict scrutiny test as set forth by the United States, in order to enact this type of legislation where it divests someone of a constitutional right, it is their burden to come in and defend the statute and show compliance of strict scrutiny. It was the government's obligation to come forward and show how they have narrowly tailored this legislation to comport with constitutional rights.
Thank you.
I see my time is out. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Leopold. I represent the presumed father and the mother. And I think there are some interesting issues here. I think from the questions that the court has been asking so far, I think what we need to focus on is what the courts have always said we need to focus on, the best interest of the child. And the cases that we cite to in the appellee brief for those policy reasons are all cases that were cited in the appellant's brief. I simply tried to explain those policy reasons from those cases. In Gunn versus Kavanaugh from 1965 out of the Texas Supreme Court, they said that fathers can forfeit their rights. In In re K was citing and explaining Stanley versus Illinois out of the US Supreme Court, the case that said that these parental rights are more precious than any property right. And the Supreme Court in In re K said, quote, "The overriding interest of state and courts is the welfare of the affected children. We are not nearly so far down the road to unrestrained egalitarianism as to hold that the Constitution guarantees an unwed father parental rights in violation of the best interest of the child." And I think that best interest, that statute of limitations, is for the best interest of the child based on a legislative policy. In N. Ray Rodriguez out of the Dallas Court of Appeals in 2008, they said, "The purpose of the time limitation for bringing a proceeding to determine parentage when a child has a presumed father is to protect the family unit." And this court stated in N. Ray St. in 2015, "The purpose of a statute of limitations in cases where a child has a presumed father is to avoid the severance of the parent-child relationship between the child and the presumed father, the psychological father. The purpose of the Uniform Parentage Act, which is Chapter 160 in the Family Code, is to protect the child involved in parentage issues. A statute of limitations in cases where the child has a presumed father usually protects the child because it preserves the established family unit." And I think where we get into that best interest is where this court said that it usually protects. And I think that's exactly what it's doing here, because there is an established family unit between the presumed father, the mother, and the child. If we look at the record, the presumed father, he testified that he changed his job when the child got into school so that he would be able to be with the child in the morning, make him breakfast, drive him to school, pick him up from school in the afternoon, help him with his homework. They have a bedtime routine. He is that established psychological father that this court talked about. And I think going beyond that 4 years strips that relationship from both of them. And I don't think the the trial court needs to necessarily determine what that best interest is. I think it's the legislative policy that put in that four-year statute of limitations. If we look to the Uniform Code, they have a two-year statute of limitations. When Texas adopted it in 2001, they bumped it up to 4 years. Even now, the Commission on Uniform Laws amended the Uniform Parentage Act in 2017 and maintained that two-year statute of limitations. Texas still has the four-year statute of limitations.
Had the biological father actually filed this within 4 years, then the statute makes it clear that the DNA would pretty much have put him in a position that it doesn't create a presumption in favor of the presumed father at that point in time. In fact, the statute protects the actual biological connection between father and child at that point in time. It's just since we've gone beyond the 4 years, all of a sudden the biological connection literally is terminated by default. Now, we have termination proceedings where the best interest of the child is a consideration. This is effectively, through creating a presumed father, an adoption that terminates the rights of the biological father through waiver without any of the ordinary protections that a biological father would have with regard to termination. Why can we not view it that way?
When we look at termination proceedings, those are parents that are normally actively raising their children. All of the cases that appellant cites to for these constitutional rights are, most of them are termination cases, and they involve parents that were actively raising their children. When we look at the facts of this case, appellant was not actively raising this child.
But in a termination case, if this had been a termination case, the burden of proof would have been on your clients to establish by clear and convincing evidence abandonment, okay, or some other wrong that was committed by the biological father here that would demand, under clear and convincing evidence, termination of his rights, and then permit an adoption by the presumed father under the circumstances. Here, because there's some inaction in 4 years, effectively the presumed father statute creates an adoption and abandonment is found without any opportunity for the biological father to actually prove a discovery rule issue, which is actually allowed by the presumed father. Isn't there a difference there in the statute? The biological father is treated differently because the biological mother can create a discovery rule issue with regard to the presumed father, but that's not allowed with regard to the biological father.
The discovery rule isn't, but paternity by estoppel is. And the trial court actually tried, I think, more so the paternity by estoppel issue here, because if we look through the record, there was actually a motion for summary judgment by my clients to dismiss the case. The case wasn't dismissed. The trial court said, I think he can try and do this estoppel. And under 160.608, a biological father, when a presumed father exists, can, through clear and convincing evidence, prove that he's the father by estoppel. There's also the common law paternity by estoppel that does not involve clear and convincing evidence, but it's basically the same facts and everything that the biological father would have to prove. So although there is not the discovery rule that could lengthen it out for the biological father, he can still prove paternity by estoppel to get around that statute of limitations. So I think he had the 4 years to bring it in the first place, and if he was actually acting as the father, then he can still bring it past that 4 years under paternity by estoppel, under 160.608 or under the common law. So I think looking back at the legislative policy to
but
put...
But that's a conduct fatherhood. That's not a biological connection fatherhood.
It could be both. So if he's the biological father and he's acting as the father, then he could bring it. If he's not the biological father, but he's still acting as the father, then he could bring that up.
But the key there is acting as a father. The conduct still is what determines it.
Correct.
Okay, the mere fact of biological connection doesn't allow for extension of the or creation of the fatherhood situation outside the statute of limitations.
Correct. Okay. And I think the same exists for the presumed father, that it's the conduct of the presumed father, because under 160.607 subsection B are the two exceptions to get around the statute of limitations outside of paternity by estoppel. So subsection two is the is when the presumed father is the petitioner and he says that he didn't know about it. That's the discovery rule. The first one anyone could bring, but they would have to show that the presumed father and the mother were not living together when the child was conceived or born, and were not having a sexual relationship when the child was the probable time of conception, which anyone would be able to prove that if the facts are there. That applies to the presumed father, the mother, or the biological father.
Now, actually, the child can actually bring an action when the child reaches majority with regard to establishing or reestablishing his biological parenthood connection, because there may be, he has certain rights that can't be destroyed by the presumed fatherhood, does he not?
In the
statute, a right to inheritance, potentially?
Potentially. In the statute itself, it says, in their 160.607, says the mother, the presumed father, or another individual has 4 years to bring their adjudication suit. I assume that to mean that any individual that has standing under 160.602, which includes the child. So I would think the child would have that 4-year statute of limitations just the same if there is a presumed father.
Except another person is in the same phrase as the child, and it doesn't make any sense to read the child as the other person in that phrase.
My point is
bottom line is there's nobody to vindicate the best interest of the child after 4 years, but before the 18-year majority is reached. So there's 14 years where the child's interests are presumptively, under the statute, protected by the presumed father with no opportunity to vindicate the child's rights with regard to the biological connection.
I don't have the statute in front of me, but I think it just says the mother, the presumed father, or another individual. I don't think it mentions the child.
It says another individual with regard to the child.
With regard
so
to
child
okay.
And another individual can't be the same person.
Okay. I understand. I still think that 4-year statute of limitations is the legislative policy, that the legislature decided this is what's in the best interest of the child to bring that, in order to bring a suit. I think under Michael H. versus Gerald V., which I believe Justice Gabriel mentioned already, the Supreme Court of the United States held, it was a plurality opinion, but they stated there that similar situation, presumed father, biological father, and the mother, biological father tried to bring suit, and the California statute said he doesn't have standing. The U.S. Supreme Court said that he doesn't have any constitutional right to that legal parentage of that child, and they just left it alone. They left it up to the California legislature, and I think that's the exact same thing that our legislature in Texas did.
So do you believe that we judge this under a strict scrutiny standard?
I don't think so. I don't think we get to that, because I don't think it is that fundamental right. Fundamental right, as the U.S. Supreme Court explained in Washington versus Glucksberg, is a right that is deeply rooted in our nation's history and tradition, and is implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. I don't think that this is a fundamental right. I think being a parent is a constitutional right, but having that adulterous affair, that's not a right at all. And so I think we don't get to there. But even if we do, even if it is a fundamental right, even if this creates a suspect class, under strict scrutiny, it normally targets things such as race and alienage or national origin, or if a fundamental right is violated. So if we do fall under strict scrutiny, a statute will be sustained if it is suitably tailored to serve a compelling state interest. I think all of the case law shows that the best interest of the child, the family unit, the relationship between the child and the presumed father all have those constitutional rights. I think those are just as much of a compelling state interest as the rights of the biological father, if not more so.
In essence, the psychological well-being of the child is a compelling state interest. Mm-hmm.
And so I think we do have that compelling state interest. So now we have to determine if that 4 years is suitably tailored. I think it is. I think under the uniform law, we just have 2 years. And Texas determined we're going to bump that up to 4 years to allow enough time to have a biological father or another person bring a suit if there's a presumed father. I think if this court were to determine that 160.607 is unconstitutional because of that 4-year statute of limitations, that would cross over to 160.609, which also has a 4-year statute of limitations when there's an acknowledged or an adjudicated father. It has the same 4-year statute of limitations, it just applies in a different situation. An acknowledged father just has to fill out the paperwork and file it with the vital statistics unit. An adjudicated father is adjudicated by the court as a father. I believe that under the equal protection laws, appellant was provided equal protection. He had the same 4-year statute of limitations that everyone else under the statute had. And if we look at the record, he knew for at least 4.5 years that he was the biological father and chose to do nothing about it. He testified at trial that he should have done something about it, but he chose not to. He found out when the child was about 6 months old that he was the father. He wanted more time with the child. He knew the courts could give him that time with the child, and he admitted that he chose to do nothing because mother would threaten him or do different things and he would just drop the subject. So I think, just as the courts have said, fathers can forfeit their rights, and I think that's just what he did here. He had that equal protection to be able to bring a lawsuit, and he chose to do nothing. And so we would ask the court to affirm the trial court's judgment that 160.607 is not unconstitutional. Thank you.
Simply because a man and a woman are married, we can come up with innumerable examples today of where a mother may be in Texas and the father may take a job in California, and there's no correlation whatsoever as to whether that's the stability of the child or not, simply because of the marital status. Second, 608 applies to ordering genetic testing and the conducts of the party.
Well, just because you can come up with different marital circumstances doesn't mean the state doesn't have some type of compelling interest in the marital institution, in the institution of marriage. In fact, Obergefell says that the state's interest in the marital institution is so important because it's important to individuals to have that institution, and that other individuals can't be deprived of that institution. So it seems to be a little bit difficult. You're essentially arguing that marriage should be ignored.
No, not at all. I think you're mixing apples and oranges. No one's challenging the sanctity of the marital relationship between the two consenting adults. That's the marital relationship. Should they choose to live in California and Texas and engage in that type of marital relationship, that's totally up to them.
But the marital relationship doesn't exist in a vacuum.
Correct, but it's the tying the two together. I really think they're two separate concepts. One is the marital relationship, and one is the parent-child relationship. And the mix, the two are, as we've seen in my practice over the last 30 years, you will see every possible combination of things that will happen. But simply because a man and a woman, or same-sex couples, are married, does not necessarily correlate to the stability of the child. And there was no evidence as to that. And the statistics show that 80% of the children, 40% out of wedlock, 50% the subject of divorce, means that the majority of the American children in 2018 are not being raised in a single dual-parent home. We have to get current with the statistics. We have to get current with the Constitution and applying to it.
Who is we? I mean, do we, the judiciary, need to get current with it? Or does the legislature need to get current with it? What's the role of the judiciary?
I think the role of the judiciary is to declare the statutes that are not current with the current rules of the Constitution unconstitutional. And Justice Chief
Well, you just mixed up the analogy there. We were talking about public policy.
Yes.
Okay. Now you're talking about the Constitution. Clearly, judges, the role of judiciary is to look at the constitutionality,
correct.
But it's not the role of the judiciary to say this policy is unwise because it doesn't reflect reality today.
No, what I'm saying is it's this court's responsibility to review statutes that do not comport with the Constitution. It is the legislature's job to then go and amend those statutes to comply with the strictures of the Constitution, like they did in Sessions. Sessions kept a federal law in place that said, through old concepts, that mothers were better parents, basically better parents than fathers. And they said, you can't do that. We are still here today in 2018, stuck with the old concept that we don't want to have illegitimate children, and we've got this concept I think we all want to hold dearly to, that we have this nuclear family in place. But that's not the reality on the ground.
Is that what makes this arbitrary, is that the institution of marriage has fallen into such disrepute that maintaining it or supporting it or encouraging it is no longer something that is of compelling interest to the state?
Once again, I think those are two separate analyses. I think absolutely we can have a compelling interest with regard to the sanctity of marriage between two consenting adults.
But our compelling interest here isn't concerning the sanctity of marriage. It's concerning the best interest of a child. And so you're going off on this other road about marriages fall apart and we have single mothers and all this. We're talking about what is in the best interest of the child. What is your best case? Because I could find no case that said that this statute of limitations anywhere, including the state of Texas, is unconstitutional. Do you have any case to support this statute of limitations being unconstitutional, either under the United States Constitution or the Texas Constitution?
No, the best cases we have is this is a developing area of law. We are challenging this statute, I think, for the first time from this biological father standpoint, where we're relying on a recent United
There's
States...
There's a Dallas case just that does that.
Correct. But also in JWT, which we cited to this court, in 1994, the biological father had no rights to even challenge or have standing to bring the suit. And in 1994, the Texas Supreme Court said that's unconstitutional. Yes, a biological father can have that right. And that's where we are. This law is evolving. We are bringing new challenges to this. But we never got to the best interest, Justice Gabriel, in this case. He was kicked out before the trial court was ever able to do his
but
job
we're talking
of, what,
about
of weighing
the
what is the best interest. Because I think, this is my prediction, if I think they had heard this case in a normal standing case where the biological father was there, the presumed father was there, and the mother was there, just Judge Hennigan could have made a best interest determination.
But is it exclusively with the judge to make that determination, or can the legislature say, we, as a policy matter, we think this is in the best interest of the child or the children?
Yes, I think it can if it meets the strict scrutiny test. And if not, it must fall.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, we thank you for your argument today. It's been very helpful. The case has been submitted. You're